I hire a team of people that I love. And then we together make, you know, have this sort of like creative family and create. I mean, that's part of what I love about making movies and TV. Jeez, it's like all fucking teamwork.
Hello and welcome back. This is The Conversation with Amanda Decadene. Every week I sit down with a woman who truly inspires me and we talk about the stuff that is really important to us and hopefully you too. Last week I talked to the badass comedian Amanda Seales at her home in LA about how if you're a woman and you're called ambitious, that is still considered an offensive word. And how just taking some time for yourself is perfectly okay, and you should do it if you feel like you need it. This week, I'm talking to Lake Bell about why she wasn't a fan of marriage for most of her life, how she recovered and healed from a very traumatic birth experience, and I think her story is something that is very brave to share and I hope will be helpful to any other women who have had a similar experience. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I had a fantasy that I would somehow go to New York today.
Yes.
And just have this weekend there and do some fashion week stuff and stay in a nice hotel.
Gorgeous.
And have some good, nice sheets that want would have kids in them and bits of food. And
so many crumbs.
You know, just nastiness. But then I realized this morning when my nanny came in, she said, so are you going to New York? I was like, no, I guess I'm not. But I play these games of like, oh, I could go that person.
Oh, you could.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
But I actually cannot.
No. But you need to be in the fantasy. You have to believe it.
Right?
Otherwise, the fantasy doesn't work.
It doesn't.
But sometimes I do that. I'm very responsible with my fantasies. And sometimes I think about things that are really extraordinary, whether it's like illicit.
Right.
Or like just kind of like fun. And even in my fantasy, I'm curbing it where I'm like, but
come on, that's not realistic.
Kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's interesting.
What does that say?
Well, that you are firmly in your reality.
Yes.
And you're present for your life. And
do you fantasize about things and then feel guilty about them, or within the fantasy feel guilty about them?
I don't even allow myself to really do that.
To sort of visualize things that are wrong or illicit?
I mean, well, you know, look, how long are you married for?
Well, I've only been married for like 6 years. We've been together 8 years.
I've been married for 15 years and been with my husband for 18 years. And I was thinking about this the other day about how, you know, even if I was like a cheater, which I'm not, but even if I was, I don't think I've met anyone that I've wanted to have sex with.
Sure.
For so long. It's not even a frame of reference for me anymore. Like, it's gone.
Oh,
you know, it's gone. It's like, no, it doesn't even cross my mind. Whereas I used to, pretty much on a daily basis, be like, could I be naked with that dude?
Right.
You know, like, I don't even think about that anymore.
So you're saying earlier in the marriage when you still felt like you would allow your brain to percolate, you know, sort of tingle in
totally.
That way.
And just my vagina to tingle in that way.
Yes, exactly. Well, just to keep it like alive
exactly.
a little bit.
Exactly.
Yes, interesting. Okay, and then eventually you're like, fuck it. Like, I'm not gonna.
I think like that kind of sex energy is a wonderful energy, and it can be electrifying. It gives you a lot of intention and, you know, amazing focus.
Mm-hmm.
But I think creative energy and sexual energy are the same thing in many ways.
Yeah.
Right? And so for me, I've definitely...
They're linked.
But I think that once I really realized, oh, I'm in for the long haul with this dude, that energy just went into creativity.
Right. And it's really interesting because I remember I went to drama school and there was this one kid, everyone was like, oh my God, he wasn't hot. He was in our school, and he was extraordinary. He was like the most amazing actor ever. No, he just won't engage in any sexual expression energy. Or energy, because he wants to pool it all into his acting. Wow. Now, I don't know where this guy went.
Yeah, I was going to say, what happened? Is it like Brad Pitt or someone?
No, it's not. and I'm sure he's doing very well, you know, somewhere. But the point is, like, he was incredible. Like, he just wielded an energy that was profound. Because it wasn't like he was not going to get any. Like, right, there was offers on the table.
Right.
It was a choice.
But the thing is that when you are withholding sexual energy and you don't disperse it, then it stays within you. And it is very contagious, right? And people are drawn to it. And I think, you know, certainly for me as a mother of three children, and I don't know whether you've found this shift, that it's really important to stay connected to that piece of yourself when the majority of your life, and I would say like 90% of my life, is about problem solving tantrums and working out what to feed everybody and how do I get the playdate person here and pick that one up from there. And you're just in like problem solving mode, and the last thing you're thinking about is your vagina.
No, I know. It's all logistics.
Yes.
It's all logistics, no vagina. Yeah.
Yes. And so, you know, I don't know if you do this, but it's so important within a marriage to have time where you're not being just parents, because you forget, who am I in relation to this man as a man and a woman in an intimate relationship, as opposed to like parents trying to get shit done.
Well, it's so funny you say that, because literally Scott and I talk about all the time, and it's like, I don't have the answer necessarily, other than, hey, want to have one date night per week? And by the way, anybody who's married with kids is kind of like, that's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Once a week?
At 6 p.m. as well.
What, are you mad? Like, who's going to, you're going to electively go out, like, when you have a 4 and a 2-year-old? Like, no. I'm
Mine
sorry.
Are 12 and it's
Sleep.
Still like that.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Don't tell me that.
I mean, I'm sorry. But the thing is that to be a mindful parent, to be
exactly.
a present parent, that is what I think personally for me, I need to do.
Now, totally
personal. Many different
yes.
parent styles, everyone's entitled to do it their own way. My own childhood informed the kind of parenting I don't want and the kind of parenting I do want.
Of course. And I think it is important to say that everybody does live life differently.
Totally.
And they do a great job in different ways, and different children need different things, you know.
I mean, God forbid that anyone should feel judged for their parenting.
No. We're all in it together, guys.
Well, I mean, we
no
are.
Matter which
we
way.
We are.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
No matter what you do,
yeah.
you're going to get judged.
There's no way around it. How did your own childhood affect your perspective on parenting?
I mean, I come from a household of where there was a divorce and it was messy, and there was like a lot of step parents and, you know, living in different states and, you know, flying back and forth. You know, it was just like very athletic. It was just
a lot.
A lot, yeah. And I think I have a good sense of humor because of it. So I'm kind of like right on.
That.
Yeah, and I feel like I have a good sense of self and am pretty like well adjusted with stuff, you know?
How do you think that happened?
I think because my mom is very nurturing and sweet, and provided a hearth of love, even in the midst of chaos. Mm. Even if I didn't see her, you know, for beats of time, it was like when I saw her, she represented like love and, oh, I hear you, I see you, I feel, you know, that must hurt.
Safety,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, safety.
Acknowledging.
Acknowledgement,
all of it.
Yeah. And I had a brother.
Younger or older?
Older. And regardless of where our relationship is now, he was my everything. You know, I mean, we just were like, this
you were
shit
in it together.
Is crazy.
Right.
We had so many inside jokes, our own language.
Wow.
We had multiple languages. We had like we did op, you know, which is like a kind of pig Latin, but then we also had kind of like a...
Oh, pig Latin's great.
We just existed in a little
you were
raft.
Teamed.
Yeah, we were like on this raft that would go to all these different places, and he was kind of naughtier than I was, and I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just keep my mouth shut. I don't want to get spanked, you know? And so that was my whole thing. I was like, I'm just going to fucking...
Right.
Slide through this and just like be the. They seem to think I'm pretty cute because I'm like a little girl, right?
Right.
That's good.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, they laughed at that thing. Okay, laughing works. Good, good, good. Check. You know, it was just like, it just started to kind of crystallize as we were the team. And then everybody else was kind of kooky. But my mom did provide like a beacon of, and of course, they'd be like, we weren't kooky. We were just going through real life stuff. Of course you were. You know yes. what I mean? Their reality is like, they're these like kids who just happened to have grown up
right.
and had kids. And we're just like in their fucking movie,
right.
you know? But of course,
which is the reality, and you kind of get to a certain age where you realize that, oh, your parents, who you held accountable for like all of the most fucked up stuff about you, were also just people doing their best.
Yeah, they're just like, I mean, they're not good at certain things,
right? Like you know? like all of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And I think that's why I think you can't have that perspective until you're a parent, you know, and you're looking at it in hindsight. But yes, I think that having that sibling was big for me because otherwise it would have been really scary without him.
So how, if you had a strong relationship with your brother, how are your relationships with men? How, because I would imagine that coming from a divorced family, and I too am from that,
yeah.
it caused epic trust issues for me, just like monumental, and still is a challenge for me. But how were your trust issues coming from a divorced family?
I used to turn every guy I dated into a brother.
Well, that's complicated, actually. Because
it is weird.
Because you don't want to be fucking your brother.
Never. And I never wanted to fuck anyone.
But,
I was just.
But
like,
if you have that relationship with the man that you are in a sexual relationship with,
very
that
confusing.
Can never turn out right.
It never does. My dad was peripheral, so I didn't have him to kind of relate to. So then I would meet a guy that I like, and I usually gravitate to friend-like mm-hmm. energy. And then, of course, I was like, well, I don't want to do
yes,
anything with you because
totally.
You're like bro vibes.
Yeah.
And they're also like, why are you turning me into a brother? You know what I'm saying? So then it would just always fizzle.
I can imagine that that was a lot of relationships that you went through trying to break that one. How did you break that pattern?
I think it was like, I was like very scrawny as a kid, whatever. I know it's like very like sort of stereotypical to be like, I was really scrawny as a kid. But I was. And it was just like knees and a nose. And it was just like basically elbows, knees, and a nose. And then when I was wet, I just looked like a drowned, like gonzo. Anyway, the point is, then I did, you know, get fucking big ass boobs like all of a sudden. And I was just like a thing that I didn't even realize. I was like, I have no fucking boobs. And I was wearing an A cup until some girl at boarding school was like, I don't think you're an A. Like, and I was just like, I looked down. I remember the moment just being like, I got like boobs and a butt. And then
right.
I was putting out something different, whether I liked it or not.
Oh, yeah. God, I remember that moment,
yeah.
too, when I was walking down the street in London wearing overalls. And I remember builders on a building site saying, oh, look at her tits. Show us your tits.
Yeah.
And me being like, what? Like, I couldn't get my head around the fact that I was being sexualized. It was one of the first times, I think, that I was sexualized.
Right.
Because I too, grew these massive boobs.
And
like,
you were
double
like,
D's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Me too, yeah.
And suddenly I was like, people looked at me differently.
I know.
And it, like, I like what you said, whether you liked it or not,
mm-hmm.
you're suddenly thrust
yep.
into having to learn about sexuality without being ready for it necessarily.
Oh, I was so not ready. I was like,
yeah.
I was so fucking not ready. If I could have been, I would have been ready at like 30.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
That would have been great to get boobs around like 28, 29, 30. You know what I'm saying? That would be great.
I think I would have had a very different life if I didn't get boobs till I was 29
right?
or 30.
Oh my God. You would have.
For real.
Yeah. You would have just like taken it easy and then just. And then, you know, once you knew what
trauma.
You were doing.
A lot less trauma.
No shit.
God.
I feel like, yeah, that was like the beginning of a change of like, oh man, I have to navigate this. Like, because I wasn't ready, obviously. When you're like, I mean, a lot of girls maybe are, but I super wasn't ready to do anything like sex or anything until I was like, I had sex at like 19.
That was the first time you had sex?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I held off.
Why did you wait
until
19?
Right. I just was like, I didn't understand dudes in
in that context.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, I don't know. Trust issues. I was like, I don't fucking trust you.
I mean, that sounds actually probably like the healthier way to go rather than forcing yourself
to do it
before you really felt like, okay, I can just about handle this.
You're right. I mean, even at 19, to be honest, I wasn't ready.
Right.
You know, if
okay, I'm 19. This is ridiculous. Just like, let's do this.
Yeah. And I was with a boy that I trusted enough to like do that with. And he was like, all right, I'll fucking wait around for you. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like, and it was in England, actually, because I went
an
to
English
drama
school.
Yeah.
You lost your virginity to an English boy.
Yeah.
So did I.
I was at school. Yeah, you did. I left America at 19, and then I was 19, 20, 21, 22. I was there.
I
went to drama school there.
Hi, this is Amanda Decadene, and I'm here to let you know that if you want to stay connected to me and the conversations I'm having, and most importantly, if you want to support this podcast, the best way for you to do it is to sign up for my Substack. That is where I share the more personal lessons I'm learning, extra wisdom from my guests, plus the tools I'm gathering from the various teachers in my life. The way you get access to all of this is by heading over to www.amandadecadene.substack.com and just sign up. Put your email in. It's totally free. So head over to www.amandadecadene.substack.com.
What was the process like for you with learning to let the man who you're married to in? You know, like, did you put him through the ringer with, like, trust trials?
I did not, because I did that with a lot of other people before I got to him. So I had some, like, really stupid, you know, kind of dysfunctional, I'm pretending to be somebody else in a relationship. I tried that on where I like think I'll try on this person.
Right.
Well, I'm like, that's
I can do this.
Yeah, I can
Let
do this.
Let me just be that girl.
Forever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then I did the one where you're like, I'm going to do something kind of illicit and then realize I'm 100% not that person.
Right.
You know, it's a lot of like trying on costumes of different people, at least for me, and then being why are you not just being yourself?
Right. But also that's a way to stay safe, because if you don't bring yourself and it doesn't work, then you've not risked anything.
Correct. And I feel like then I had a relationship right before I met my husband where I finally experimented with being me. And that was awesome.
I'm bringing Lake to the party.
Yeah. And I was like with somebody that I really trusted and loved. They weren't the person for the long haul, but they were like the most profoundly like respectable and kind. And like, I was like, wow, I'm like in a real thing where I can be kind. They can be kind to me. I can fucking accept it. They can accept it. Holy shit.
Gave you an insight into what you could do. But also you matched up with someone who was willing to do it with you, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because I mean, that's one of the hardest things is finding someone who's willing
to do that too.
Yeah, because you've got two people who have got, you know, damage and restrictions and are just not, you know, and not willing to take that risk at that point.
Some people get a lot of currency and feed off of the, you know, the bacteria of dysfunction. You know, it's the familiar horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which I always found really interesting because I was in a cycle of familiar horrible for a while where I would be dating concepts and textures that were like the relationship I had with my father, which a lot of girls do. You know, it's like that
that's the story of my life.
Like the kind of like you're far away.
The unavailable.
You're
not Available,
they kind of
unavailable.
Look around. They don't look at you only.
I used to do that where it's like the one available motherfucker in the room is the one that did not want to talk to me, was not interested in having a conversation with me. That was the one that I wanted to be with.
I know. Why do girls do that?
Oh,
it's
God.
So weird.
See, it is so bizarre, but it is understandable, and it is a horrible pain. I mean, I'm with one person for a long time, but I don't think I would have that anymore if I wasn't in a relationship.
No. I think that you do grow out of that. I think the good news is if someone was listening, they're like, I do that. Like, I just think that goes away. You do have to work with it. I mean, I'm like a therapy girl. Like, I go to therapy.
Yeah, I do too.
And I love it.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I experience it myself all the time where, you know, I'm a female founder of a company. I interview people. I've had my own television show for many years. I'm one of very few women who gets to do that. But the restrictions that are in place are so monumental. Even with raising money for my company, the fact that female founders only get 2% of VC funding, the thing of every time we walk into a room, knowing that that what we're bringing, that those people are lucky to have our talent, our time, our ideas, as opposed to, I hope you like me. I hope you invest in me. And I still think that that is a huge part of our culture. Maybe our kids will have, their generation is a phenomenal generation. They give me hope. Gen Z just give me hope because they are growing up in a time where they know that their voice means something because they're used to growing up on social. They see, they're exposed to the news and awful, you know, inequalities and horrendous things that are happening in the world, which is a lot for their little minds to deal with.
Yeah.
But they have more of a sense of, oh, they appreciate if they have any privilege, they're more aware of it. They're aware of people who don't have it. I think that our kids' generation is in a much better place, but I still think the people-pleasing thing has not gone, and I don't think it will go.
I don't know that it would go either.
Sorry, that was a major tirade I just went on.
No, it was, and I think I was interested in your comment about sort of, you know, funding, you know, as a woman, and because I am, you know, I consider myself a content generator and a producer of those things and director, obviously, and writer. But like, I, you know, have been in a position where I feel like I have had a favorable response in trying to generate funds for projects that I'm excited about. Now, that said, because I'm on the board of Women in Film, and it is for years now, and I feel like, you know, women of color really do have it a lot harder in a very massive, very profound, like, painful way.
Huge.
So I do feel like a lot of our work in women in film, you know, is dedicated to not only just women of color, but also mid-career women, right? So say you've made a couple of movies, right?
Well, a lot of women get to make one film, but
exactly,
not a second.
But not a second, or not, but better yet, not a third. And that's interesting. And so that's something that we're always looking at because we're like, well, what's going on here? Because
well, same with funding, by the way. Women get seed funding, but they don't often get Series A and certainly not Series B.
Well, exactly. And that means there's like some sort of like ageist kind of, I don't know. It's like, it's multifaceted. You know what I mean? It's like, why? Oh, we gave you a chance to make a movie already. You're done now. You know what I mean?
That's your one opportunity.
Yeah, you got to make, for me, I got to make two, you know? It's like, and I'm excited to make a third. Instead, I pivoted and wanted to be like, I'd like to know what it feels like to run a ship of a network comedy, because then I have a lot of—
Are you show running too?
So I executive produce, I direct the premieres, and then I star in it, and then I write on it. I show run with Liz Merriweather. So Liz Merriweather is...
Oh, yeah. She's wonderful.
Is like, she's the day-to-day in writing scope, and I'm on set day-to-day on EPing. So obviously I'm also starring in it, so I'm there, but I also serve as a creative
barometer guide.
It's satisfying in a different way, and I had never done it before. So I was like, okay, if the goal is to kind of attack big obstacles, things that feel unsurmountable, that's interesting. You know, it's like, oh, what network comedy? I'd love to take like an independent filmmaking sensibility and bring it to everyone. Why not?
Yeah, and, you know, do you feel like the fact that you're able to be a part of not only the creative process with writing, but also obviously you're acting in it, but as an EP on top of it, I know for me on my show, the fact that I was involved in every single piece of it, it gave me way more control over the output ultimately.
I mean, 100%. I'm a complete, I don't like to say control freak because I'm just like a control.
You care about the details.
I just
nothing
care.
Wrong with that.
It's not freakish. I'm very specific. And
by the way, every single person I know who is excellent at what they do, which you are, is very specific.
And that's cool.
I think the difference between good and great is the details.
Yeah, and I feel like you can do it with great respect and love and collaboration. I know it feels funny to say that, you know, to be specific and to be, you know, direct, it doesn't feel collaborative, but it's extremely collaborative. I hire a team of people that I love, and then we together make, you know, have this sort of like creative family and create. I mean, that's part of what I love about making movies and TV. Jeez, it's like all fucking teamwork, you know, and we're all in it together. You get to laugh with people. You get to be like, oh, God, you fail. You know, you pick up again and then figure shit out. I mean, holy shit. It's so fun.
But what do you do when you have someone on your team who isn't being a team player, or someone who you hired because you thought they had a certain skill set and they presented it as such, and then you get to work and you realize, oh, this person doesn't have that skill set at all?
You fire them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that is also part of being... It sucks.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Have you had to do that?
Yeah, but I don't like it at all. It makes me want to barf. Yeah. I hate it. I love giving people the chance to step up, like, and to, you know, we have the conversation first. I let them know where the limitations or where the weaknesses are lying right now, and then they have the opportunity to rise up. Mm-hmm. That's a great, oh my God,
yeah, that's
the best part.
Scenario.
Yeah. And then if they don't, then you fire them.
Yeah.
But like, you know, with love and respect, you know, I'm not ruthless. And I feel like I do have a heart. I do think about people in terms of them having families. And maybe that's a female,
that's a female leadership. Absolutely.
Yeah. Female leadership. Yeah. I do go, oh God, you know, I see that, but it doesn't mean I can keep you just because I feel bad. You know,
well,
that
would not be good leadership, to be honest, because that would mean that your feelings are dictating, you know, very practical decisions that need to be made for the business.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a bit about mental health, because let's make a complete
little pivot
here, because one of the things that I read when I was reading about you was that you said that there was a period of time where you took antidepressants and that you, and I wanted to know if they helped you, and I wanted to know if, why you chose to make that public, because I think there's a huge stigma around, unfortunately, and there should not be, around mental illness, but specifically around medication. And I think that is very damaging, and I wish people were more open and honest about what worked for them, even if it was for a period of time. So I admired that you were honest about that.
Yeah, thank you. I had a very traumatic birth thing of my second child. You know, I had gone through life not understanding medication at all, not being on board. I would think of it as kind of like something to, that's like the last resort as opposed to the first, you know? And so I didn't really understand it. My judgment came from living a very sort of like holistic life and like very wellness centric. And, you know, I only take Advil if it's absolutely necessary. You know, I'm very, very low key with that shit. And I, you know, it's the organic fucking kumbaya way of very new age, whatever.
I get it.
Yeah. And I mean, my best friend growing up, Kate and her family, you know, that's why I did 2 home births, you know, cause now I would say to you, like everyone, I'm like, I'm not saying you have to do a home birth. I'm saying I chose to do home birth because I had my best friend growing up had 4 kids at home, and it's what I knew. She started
it's
when
what
I was,
you knew.
It's just what I knew. And I thought, oh, I'm terrified of hospitals. I don't want to go to a hospital. So my second birth with Ozzy, he was 11 pounds. There were complications at home. And he, you know, needless to say, it was just, I mean, it just doesn't get worse. But he's okay now and everything's fine. But after his birth, when we were in the NICU for a number of days at Children's Hospital LA, you know, they were saying things like he was there. We didn't know whether he would be alive or whether he would walk or talk. And it was just a moment where, like, the only thing you could look at was, like, a tree swaying in the distance to kind of orient yourself. That tree is a good constant to just look at. And then the sky behind it, which you know will be there tomorrow. You know what I mean? There's all these things. You're, like, at that level. And I was like, I need something. I can't. I can't be a person. I don't know how to be. I kept saying, I don't know how to be. Mm. And you had a little daughter too. Yeah. So I was like, I gotta be a person. And I don't know how to find that. The person that, you know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And so I think I had never felt that before. And, you know, I feel terrible for, my heart aches for those who feel that through the hardship of their life, like every day. Like, I have felt it. I know what it is. And it's a monster, you know? It's
a
demon. And I remember my daughter saying at one point, I was lying in bed and it was nighttime and I was just like swirling with darkness. And, you know, by the way, you also have like all the like, all that, all those hormone crash, everything right after, right?
Oh my God.
And you're just like, you know, like all the women, all the like bitches who have kids before, they like, they know exactly what we're talking about. It's very hard to know what that, like waterfall of crashing hormones is like without the feeling of my baby's in my arms, my right? So it's
Which
very
is the
confusing.
Antidote to it.
Yes, that's the antidote. That's built in. That's some nature shit.
Yeah.
And when you don't have the baby there and it's in a dire situation, then your body and your chemicals and your hormones are like discombobulated. And my daughter, it was nighttime and it was dark outside. And she looked into the corner and she was little. She was 2.5. And she said, she was sucking her thumb and she goes, "Go away, monster. You go away." And I was like, I was like, "Honey, what? Are you okay? Is there a monster here?" And she said, "He's still here. Go away, monster. You can't play here." And I was like, quiet, looking around like, is there a fucking ghost here? And I was looking around and this was the very room where, you know, my son was born. And I sat there and then she said, "He went away." And she put her thumb back in her mouth. And then, you know, as I sat there and she sort of like fell asleep in my arm, I was like, I know what she's talking about. She feels that I'm not normal mommy. She feels that there's like a fucking demon in the goddamn room and she wants it to get the fuck away. Mm. It was a feeling of a little person being very intuitive to there being like a cloud of darkness here. And she was like trying to get it away. And so in that moment and understanding and viscerally experiencing that, I took a medication called Zoloft, very low dose. And this was, again, a person who was afraid of Advil, and I begged for it. I begged for it. And I begged for it for my own well-being and for my family's well-being, and so that I could produce milk. And I did.
Wow.
And my milk came, and I was on extremely low dose. And yet it took me to a place where I could be. I could just be.
Medication doesn't make you happy. It just allows, it creates a tiny buffer for you to be able to think rationally.
It was rational. Yeah. I needed rational. Yeah. I needed to just be Lake. And I felt finally like I could breathe the air that Lake breathes, not like some other person that I don't recognize. And I was on Zoloft for a year and then I tapered off.
What have you done with your feelings about how your son's birth evolved? Because even though intellectually I can imagine that I would understand this is no fault of mine, as a mother, there is always a piece of us that feels endlessly responsible. So how have you processed that and those feelings?
That's a huge reason why I was on Zoloft, was feeling guilt for not listening to my body, right? So like I had a lot of cues that I was too big to birth at home, but my caregiver, my
doula,
midwife, was not available to make that call. And I felt let down for sure. I mean, Nova was born and she was not breathing when she came out, but she was revived with three life-saving breaths on my chest, and it was the most miraculous, incredible, profound thing I'd ever seen in my life. You know, birth, death, life. Boom.
Nothing more profound.
Yeah. And so that, I think, gave me a big respect for the prowess and, you know, sort of abilities of a trained midwife. And I had a different midwife in LA. And I had had cues emotionally, physically, that I could tell that the baby was a lot bigger. That I had 11 pounds in there. And yeah, I couldn't get him out. And so he had the cord wrapped around his neck, and his heart rate dropped. And so then it became, I have to get him out or he's not going to be with us. So then I ripped myself open to get him out. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I'm sure it'll be, I hope, fucking A, that is the hardest thing I'll ever deal with. But it, physically, at least. And he was not with us when he came out, and we could not revive him. And so the paramedics came in extremely short amount of time. But first, we did try to revive him. He was connected to me, so he had oxygen through the blood, but then he was hypoxic and without oxygen for over the amount of minutes then that is considered okay. And that is why he was in the NICU and was put on a cold bed for 72 hours. So he was in an induced coma and intubated. And I looked at him and I was told that he, you know, may have cerebral palsy or he could be totally fine. And that is the framework that we're talking about. And so I went through that roller coaster of insanity for almost 12 days. Mm. And so he was, And every day, you know, Scott slept there and I came in the mornings so I could be home with my daughter at night to sleep with her at night. And then and so that was that time when I decided to medicate and get through the day. When you're in a situation like that, it's like you almost, like, guilt and blame is so vain. Mm. It's like, who fucking cares? Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the matter at hand. You know, it's like I need to figure out what the fuck is going to happen and how I can help and what I can do and how to move forward. Because that would be Zoloft and therapy that helped me. Because, by the way, I was going through therapy religiously through that process. It wasn't just like taking a pill and not taking care of my actual...
No, it's a combination.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah, both. And by the way, thank you for sharing that story.
I mean, I'm trying to honor Ozzy, I think, a little bit. And I also, because I feel like, you know, at that, I wasn't ready to ever talk about it. And now I'm like, oh, look, if there's other women, because I did talk about it with Dax on his podcast, and I had a tremendous amount of... women saying thank you and kind of saying, hey, you know, this happened to me, or I'm pregnant and this is a really heavy story to listen to while you're pregnant, but thanks. And it sobers you up a little bit. And I give great credit and love and respect to any woman, no matter how you give birth. So everybody's got a story. You ain't getting out of a story. There's no way that you can give birth and be like, it was easy.
Well, I think that we have talked about so much.
Indeed. Thank you.
And thank you for showing up, and thank you for being willing to share stories and talk about things that I think will be really helpful and really insightful to so many people.
I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, as ladies and as parents, I will include men in that for sure, because I have a husband who's a badass dad.
So do I.
Yeah. And like, I think parents, you know, we're in it. We really are in it together. And especially if you work hard too, and you have, you know, you are trying to contribute to all of the things that are important to you in the world, whether that's, you know, your health, your family, your career, and what you contribute to just the world at large. Those can be all be priorities, and it just means there's no answer to the balance thing, you know, which we all talk about. I think it's just you do your best, and something.
I look at it like the whack-a-mole toy that the kids have, where you know you hit one thing and another thing pops up.
Oh,
it's like you can't have everything in equilibrium. There are things that you have to prioritize, and then you have to go back and reprioritize the things you put on the back burner. It's just moving stuff around, right?
Yeah.
And listening to your intuition and paying attention and going, oh, that thing's on fire, or before that catches on fire, I need to move that up to a priority.
Yeah,
it's just moving shit around.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like I always think about. I'm like, I'm globally a good mom, so every day I'm a good mom.
Right.
But some days I'm a great mom.
Right.
And sometimes I'm a good mom.
But sometimes I'm not a great mom, and I'm okay.
That's okay because globally,
right,
you're a good mom.
Yes. All right, I'm going to go about my day with this. Thank you, Link Bell.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you have any ideas for me of guests that you want me to interview, or indeed questions that you might have for certain guests that you know I'm interviewing, you can now share that information with me directly into my iPhone, 917-708-8499. I would love to hear from all of you. I make this for you. I want it to be something that you enjoy and people that you want to hear from. So text me. The Conversation with Amanda Decadenay is a Spotify original podcast, executive produced by me, Amanda Decadenay. From Spotify, our executive producers are Natalie Teller and Erica Clark. Our production partner is Neon Hum, which includes the team of Jonathan Hirsch, Catherine St. Louis, Joanna Clay, and Marissa Schneiderman. And while I've got your attention, please listen to all episodes of The Conversation with Amanda Decadenay on Spotify for free.